Okay, we're going to start shifting Perek Yud. This Perek was a long Perek which described one of the more tragic events and periods of during the time of the Shifting. They're very short, and I'm recapping this because it's relevant to what we just saw now. It was the only instance in which somebody used force to try to seize the throne, Avimelech, and we ended this. He killed all of his brothers, 70 people, in order to seize the throne. And as we said last week, this was the only case in the history of the period of the Shoftim, a period of about 400 years, where any such thing happened. The Jews were, as we stressed many times, throughout this period, before the first king was anointed, the Jews lived without a government, because they governed themselves. They governed themselves according to the Torah. They didn't need a government. And therefore there was room for people to come and abuse this situation. This is what happened with Avimelech. Developed a situation of anarchy, fighting between him and his opponents, until him and many of his opponents met a very, very violent end. That's what we saw last week. Now, the question is, so what happens now? This was already a precedent in the history of the Jewish people, where someone comes, uses violence. This is something that's very common in all the nations of the world, but among the history of the Jewish people, this was the first. A person comes and tried to seize the throne, violence, killing, etc. The whole dirty story. So what happens after he's gone? Does this already mark a new period in the history of the Jewish people? Have we already departed from the period in which Klal Yisrael was able to live peacefully without a government? Are we going to now have other people trying to pull this stunt? Other people vying for the throne? So, therefore, it's actually very significant that the next piece of Navi describes a very nondescript period of the Jewish people. So, let's see, and we'll put it into perspective. So it says, Vayokom acharei Avimelech lohishia es Yisrael. After Avimelech died, he had held the throne by force for the couple of years that he reigned. After him, somebody else arose to save the Jewish people, to serve as a shofet. Tayla ben Pua ben Doidai. A man by the name, this here we're going back to the original tradition of the shoftim, righteous men who simply guided the Jewish people through their virtue. This is what Tayla ben Pua ben Doidai was. Ish Yisachar, of Shevet Yisachar. V'yoshev b'Shamir b'Har Ephraim. He lived in Shamir in Har Ephraim. By the way, I'll just note, it says Tola ben Pua ben Doidai. What does ben Doidai mean? Does it mean that he was ben Doidai, if you translate it from Hebrew, means the son of his uncle? Does it mean that he was Avimelech's cousin? So there are two opinions on that. There's actually two versions of the Targum. Rashi says, based on one version of the Targum, that no, Doidai was simply the name of his father. Tola ben Pua had nothing to do with Avimelech. This was a new personality. He was Tola, the son of Pua, the son of a man named Doidai. But others say that no, he was actually a cousin of Avimelech. He didn't become Shevet because he was a relative of Avimelech, rather because he was a relative of Gidon's family who had been the Shevet before him. But whatever it is, Tola ben Pua became the Shevet, and he dwelt in Shamir in Har Ephraim. Vayishpoites Yisrael 23 shana. And he judged the people of Israel for 23 years. Vayomos. And he died, Vayikaver b'Shamir. And he was buried in Shamir. This is probably the most scant description that we have of any of the Shoftim. It doesn't say anything about what he did, no spectacular wars, no events. Tola ben Pua rose, judged the Jewish people for 23 years, and died. Next, Vayokom acharav. We'll get back to this, but I just want to first see the picture. Vayokom acharav Yoir HaGiladi. After him arose Ya'ir of Gilad. Vayishpoitas Yisrael Esrivishtayim Shana. And he judged the Jewish people for 22 years. Vayihiloy Shloishim Banim. You know, the Navi does tell us one thing about him, but a seemingly insignificant point. He had 30 sons, which, okay, was more common in those days when people had more than one wife. They were prestigious people. They used to ride young donkeys. As we know, for was a sign of prestige. And they owned 30 cities, meaning they were a well-to-do family. And these areas were referred to as the towns of Yair. Right? These were his towns. Until this very day, until the time Sefer Shoftim was written, that was in the land of Gilead. Vayamas Yair, and Yair died, Vayikaver b'Kamayim. And he was buried in Kamayim. Okay, we just breezed through the periods of two Shoftim without much to say about them. Kind of looks like a nondescript period. But the truth is that on the contrary, we have to realize that it's the nondescript periods that are sometimes from the most significant. Why? Because as we've stressed many times, the Navi was primarily focused on the faults of the Jewish people. And when there were faults, it was immediately brought out, harped on, magnified, and the Jewish people were very much castigated. When we see that the Navi just breezes through 23 years and then another 22 years, a period of 45 years basically without comment, that is a great stamp of excellence for that time. And we have to note that, because again, throughout the Sefer we keep seeing problems, problems. Again they made problems and Hashem had to save them. There were no wars here, there was no nothing. The land was peaceful for 45 years. This was basically a stamp of approval of the Navi for this period. Understanding that, I want to back up and I'll talk and take into perspective who exactly these people were, even though the Navi is very quiet about them. But on the contrary, that's where the Navi is bringing down their greatness. Telem and Po and Yoyo Agil Adi both served as Shoftim between the two of them for a period of 45 years, in which basically things were uneventful. Uneventful means that the Jewish people were living up to the very high standards that Hashem set up for them, because otherwise Hashem came down on them hard. So first of all, it's especially noteworthy. Before I should make a point out of this, who was the first of these Shoftim? Toila ben Pua. What does the word Toila mean in Hebrew? Toila means a worm.
Doesn't sound like it.
What's that? What? Taylor? I have to remember that in those days, basically all names were original. All names were original. Some are left over until today, and therefore we're more familiar with those, but all names were original in those days. Every parents named their children based on innovation. So, Taylor means a worm. And the Kliyakar and other Mepharshim say that this really signifies that he was a very, especially unassuming person. Yeah, very humble, unassuming, quiet. Now, if you say that it's a bit of a stretch to read all this into the name Toila, then where did he live? In Shamir. It's already a little bit too illusionary to just ignore. What's Shamir? Shamir is also a type of worm. So he called him Toila ben Pua. It says that he lived in Shamir. It's already hard to ignore the allusions to the worm. So yes, he was a very, very unassuming person, which is, once again, brings out the significance of what we said before. That after such a period of violence, anarchy, when you would think that now, you know, there are going to be troublemakers arising all over Eretz Yisrael. Now we need a man who's very, very strong, will be able to regain control. Nothing. No, nothing. Avimelech was a fiasco, and once he died, that was it. It wasn't the phenomenon that was going to be repeated. Now, after him came a quiet, unassuming Shoftim that was able to quietly and peacefully lead the Jewish people for 23 uneventful years with no major events, no wars, no anything. And that itself we have to know. No wars, right? We kept seeing spectacular wars. He led the Jewish people means that the Jewish, the wars always developed from problems that came from when the Jewish people's spiritual standards stopped or dropped. This man led the Jewish people, guided the Jewish people in a way that their spiritual standards did not drop at all. There were no wars, neither during his period nor during the period of Yagil Adi Efter. And the Mefarshim, really the Mekubalim, Ramami Pano, Rabbi Moshe David Vali, makes a very interesting point about this Tehillah Bin Pur. They say also the word Shamir is a type of word, but it's a specific type of word. Shamir, you might remember from famous Gemaras, Shamir was a type of word that you were able to split stones with. Right? When they needed to, there were certain stones for the Beis HaMikdash that they needed to cut, but they couldn't use metal. How do you cut stones without metal? You ever try sawing a stone with a plastic knife? It doesn't work. They used the Shamir. It was a worm that had this quality of being able to simply very, very quickly cut through stone. Yeah, this Tehillah Bin Pur was very unassuming, quiet, like a worm. But they put it in the Kabbalistic term that, but like the Shamir, he was able to take on and battle the strongest, the most formidable of Kleifes HaTumah. In his quiet and assuming way, but with his strength of character, with his strength of personality, he was able to achieve impossible things. This quiet, unassuming Tehillah Bin Pur, who had the demeanor and the disposition of a worm. Reminiscent of, just mentioned as a point of interest, at the Brisker Rav and the Chazon Ish, basically were leading the Torah community at the same time. They were contemporaries. And people noted that the two seemed to have different approaches. The Brisker Rav was a lot more quicker to take action. Like, he was quicker to condemn things. He would detect subtle problems and different phenomena, and he would downstairs. We always have it up here. Not for the last half a year, but whatever it is, we're here. He was quick to detect very subtle problems, and then he would wage an all-out war on whatever that phenomenon was. Whereas the Chazon Ish would say, "That's okay, meanwhile. We don't have to make a whole fight out of this." So someone in front says to the Brisker Rav, "Is there a difference of approach between you and the Chazon Ish? You seem to deem things unacceptable where the Chazon Ish is willing to tolerate them." So the Brisker Rav said, "No, there's no difference in approach. What I deem unacceptable, he deems unacceptable also. And he's not willing to tolerate phenomena any more than I am. Just what? You know what the difference between us is?" he said. "So the difference is that when I see a young shoot starting to grow, I might detect a problem that will only manifest once the tree reaches full maturity." More people? Yeah. Okay, good. I might detect problems. Really, parentheses now. This is not really the. That will only develop once the tree reaches full maturity. So you see a problem in a young shoot, in a sapling, a certain danger that it holds to society. But that will only really become dangerous once it really becomes a full grown tree. So do you say, "Well, now it's a young shoot, let's tear it out and avoid the problems"? Or do you say, "Well, right now it's not a problem. Wait till it develops into a fully grown, mature tree, and then we'll uproot it"? So he said, "I take the pragmatic approach that you see a problem with the young shoot," the Brisker Rav said. "You see a problem with the tiny young shoot, even though there's nothing dangerous about it right now." "I know. Hi, sorry, I told Nehemiah, I'm sorry. I didn't realize that everyone thinks it's downstairs. But, you see, basically now, you have something that's a piece of grass. We're in the middle of something parenthetical, we're not really on the main subject right now. But now it's going to become a danger later when it's a full grown tree. Take the pragmatic approach, tear out the piece of grass now while it's still easy to do so." So Brisker Rav said, "That's my approach. I see a certain phenomenon. I see that there's a spiritual problem that can develop it, that can develop years down the road. I'll battle it now." The Chazon Ish's approach is, He also agrees with me as to what's a problem, what's not. Why does he take a more easygoing approach? Not because he's more tolerant than I am, but because his approach is, no, right now it's a sapling, right now it's not causing problems. It'll cause problems when it's a fully grown tree, when it's a fully grown tree, or even when it's Mount Everest, if we need to uproot it, we'll uproot it. Meaning, in other words, the Chazon Ish has the strength of character and the confidence that it will nothing will ever develop into too formidable a problem to take on. As long as it's not a problem, we don't have to worry about it. Because when it doesn't become a problem, we'll fight it successfully, no matter how great it is. That's what the Mishkarot said. While it might seem that he's more tolerant than I am, it's not true. I want to nip problems in the bud before they turn into problems, because I am apprehensive that once it billows out of control, who knows what it'll be. And the Chazon Ish says, no such thing as out of control. It'll grow into a Mount Everest, we'll uproot it then too. We'll do the impossible. So that's basically his Teilah Ben Pur. We just began Perek Yud. He's introducing a new Shevet, Teilah Ben Pur. He's saying Teilah Ben Pur lived in Shamir, which the Mefarshim put, not the Mefarshim really, in the Kabbalah we might say, not the classic Mefarshim, but significance to the fact that both Teilah and Shamir denote a word. So he was the style of the Shamir, very quiet, unassuming, like a worm. But in his quiet, unassuming way, he was able to tackle the greatest of problems and simply break, cut right through them. In fact, and this is something interesting, the Rambam Ipano says, Teilah Ben Pur actually later came back as a Gilgul in the form of Ben Yehu Ben Yehoyada, who was the one who actually dealt with the Shamir and used the Shamir to cut through the stone to for the Beis HaMikdash. But this was Teilah Ben Pur. As we just explained, his greatness, the greatness of his period, is illustrated dafka in the nondescript way which is presented in the Navi. Two short psukim, Teilah Ben Pur arose, judged the Jewish people for 23 years and died. The very fact that there's nothing else to be said about it, there was nothing spectacular that happened then, is the greatest sign of the greatness of that period. Then, Vayakom Acharov Ya'ir Hagil Adi. After him arose Ya'ir Hagil Adi. Vayishpoit es Yisrael 22 shana. And he judged the Jew Israel for 22 years. Vayihiloi, and then the Navi described how he had 30 sons. It was a whole prestigious family. So the Moshe David Mali, again one of the Mekubalim, one of the Talmidim of the Ramchal, says that actually Yoyah Giladi was a direct continuation of Teilah Ben Pur. They were both achieving the same thing spiritually. Yoyah Giladi was a direct spiritual descendant of Teilah Ben Pur. Just Teilah Ben Pur, as we said before, was noted for his unassumingness. His unassumingness, he was quiet, nondescript, but with his great personality was able to get very great things done and able to hold the Jewish people at a very, very elevated level for his 23 years from Shevetun. There were no wars, no anything in this period, because he kept them up to them to the desired level. Yoyah Giladi, something interesting, the way that Rabbi Moshe David Mali puts it, he says that in all elements of spirituality, there's the hidden element and then there's the revealed element. The hidden element is behind the scenes. And then there's the revealed element. Just the simple example. Torah. Right? Any Torah that you learn has its revealed element, right? Shor shenoga chesapara, an ox gore is a cow. And then there are the deeper secrets that are behind it, that are under the surface. This is really, Teilah Ben Pur and Yoyah Giladi were both on the Kabbalistic level achieving they were on a joint career to achieve certain things, to bring the Jewish people to a certain level, achieve certain things for the Jewish people. This Yoyah Giladi was the higher up Lord, Teilah Ben Pur was the higher up more sublime level. And therefore, his period was characterized by the unassuming nature. You almost didn't notice him. Things ran perfectly smoothly, but he was unassuming, quiet behind the scenes. Like we said, he was taking on very, very difficult battle. He might have fought things like a shamir, like we said, cutting through stone. But you didn't see much of him. Almost nondescript. Whereas Yair, as his name implies, Yair is the one who lights up. So he said the revealed level is the level that lights up, right? It's easily visible, etc. He was made much more of an impact, made much more of an impression on the Jewish people in the sense of his prestige. Right? He was known for his family with all of their pomp. The 30 sons were known to be riding around on the white donkeys, and the Jewish people actually took pride in it. That's what they used to call it. It says that they had their 30 towns that they owned. It was a family that was known for their wealth, their prestige, and for their righteousness in properly judging the Jewish people, to the extent that instead of the wealth and the prestige becoming a subject of jealousy or anything like that, this family became a source of pride of the Jewish people. Like, these are our leaders. They were proud of them. They were like an icon. And therefore, what's that?
Aren't white donkeys a problem?
Are they? It doesn't say white. It says young donkeys. But I don't know. Are white donkeys a problem? Maybe they are. I don't know. And therefore, it also says that they called their cities Chavos Yair. They called their cities the towns of Yair. The truth is, this also has a lot of significance because Chavos Yair is not an original name. If you remember, back in Sefer Devarim, the term Chavos Yair comes up. Yair was one of the sons of Menashe. And he personally went and conquered certain towns which then became called Chavos Yair. This is recorded in the Torah. This was a very, very famous incident. And the Chavos Yair stood for the rest of history as a symbol of his bravery, of his courage, of his greatness. It was a monument to his personality. So the Jewish people took to calling this Yair, who had the same name as him. He wasn't obviously not the same person, but much later in history, had the same name as him. They took to calling his estates Chavos Yair, like as though to grant it that level of prestige as they related to the original Chavos Yair. That's what the Malbim says. Vayomos Yair vayikovel b'kamoy. And then Yair died and he was buried in Kamoy. So, yes. We have to note that what the Navi presents is very short shrift, nondescript, uneventful era in the period of the Shoftim. The very fact that it's presented in such a nondescript way, knowing the style of the Navi, shows that this was actually a very great period, which, as we said before, is especially significant in the fact that that's what immediately followed the whole terrible story of Avimelech. The whole terrible story of Avimelech did not manifest as a general drop of the Jewish people. You didn't have troublemakers rising all over the place. Right after that story of Avimelech, there was a beautiful period of 45 years where the Jewish people adhered to the very high standards Hashem expected of them, and they simply passed uneventful. But then these two noted leaders died. The Jewish people were left without a leader. And problems started to crop up again. Now let's understand. We have to have this in the right perspective. Because, as we've said many times, the natural understanding is, these are such troublemakers. And every time you leave them alone for a minute, they're back busy with their idols. But we have to understand the state of the Jewish people in their state, in Eretz Yisrael at the time. Again, like we said before, there was no government. Each man was basically expected to conduct his life, like the Navi says, Ish Hayashav Eilav Yaseh. People conducted their lives according to their concept of righteousness, which is meant, like we said, not sarcastically but seriously. This is how people lived. The Jewish people did not require a government. It was the greatest kvod shamayim in the fact that the Torah alone, without a medium, was able to govern the lives of the Jewish people as a whole. Now, we have to realize, though, that the Jewish people were not robots, as we stressed last week. The Jewish people had Yetzirah like anybody else, as we stressed last week. And therefore, certainly, not everybody was up to this level. Not everybody was up to this level. Now take into account another thing. In Judaism, in the Jewish state of then, there was no cultural development. There was no cultural advancement. There was never change. The Jews had a lifestyle and their culture that was basically, if you will, monotonous. There's the Torah, the values of the Torah, the expectations that the Torah has for you, aspiring for those levels, and that was all. There was no literature. There were no... Every nation thrives on novelty, on new development, on new styles. There's always new things coming up, changes. Fashions change. Entertainment changes. Tastes change. Culture changes. And the masses need this. Things get boring after a while. Right? Things need to change. I think I mentioned that... toward the end, in the 1890s, one of the great minds of the time said that the era of invention has ended, because anything conceivable has already been invented. It said somebody at the end of the 1890s. Everything conceivable has already been invented. There isn't really anything left to invent. But no. What do you say today? If you would look at every 2 weeks, if you buy the latest gadget, it gets outdated, right? Always need new. The truth is that I realized how backward I am. I was just in America for a few weeks, Sukkot time. Just went to downtown Toronto and Manhattan, and just the technological state of the world. I'm not really living in the dark ages here in Olat Beit Shemesh. Like, not a part of the real world. And this was going in all the nations. In all the nations, there were all kinds of things going on. There were forms of entertainment. There was literature. Among the Jewish people, I have to remember, there wasn't even spiritual literature. There was the Torah. Nothing else was allowed to be transcribed. You wanted to learn, you went to a Rebbe, you learned Baal Peh. There was only one text, the Torah. Hashem had very, very, very high expectations of the Jewish people. He expected them to find all of their gratification, all of their fulfillment, in this program that He set out for them, without any need for cultural development, advancement, change, novelty, etc. And this is how the Jewish people lived, by and large. Did this come naturally? No. Everybody who wanted to live up to this level had to work very hard. That was what Hashem demanded of the Jewish people. A great career of growth, self-perfection, etc. Does everybody do that? There were certainly individuals who wanted fun. Even they, what? Who wanted fun. Right? There were certainly even areas of people who had sunk more. And not everybody was up to par. And you have to remember that these nations were all around them and also among them, as we stressed all the way back at the beginning of Sefer Shoftim. The fact that the Jewish people did not do a good job at ridding the land of the foreign presence at that time resulted in the fact that they always had to contend with the lure of idolatry and with the lure of foreign culture that always existed among them. So there were always new and exciting things going on. These people made ideologies of the most base human lusts, right? And they developed philosophies behind it too. And there was change, and there was advancement. And there was all of the trappings of a modern world. We're talking about a much more primitive modern world, but a modern world nonetheless. Our world will also be a primitive modern world in 500 years from now, if Chas V'Shalom Mashiach doesn't come. Right? And the natural situation should always be such that influence, on the material level, the Jewish people did not have a culture that could compete with that on the material level. Just what? If they would apply themselves to Hashem's program, they'd be able to hover above material reality. But on the material level, if we'll call it the realistic level, the other cultures and the other influences should definitely have overrun and basically squeezed this archaic lifestyle, which had seen no change in 250 years, should have just pushed it away. And for the people who it was just lip service, for the people who weren't really there with their whole being, it did. And this is why, yes, problems cropped up whenever a leader died. Did it mean? It certainly does not mean that all the Jewish people, as soon as the Shofet died, the entire Jewish people took off their yarmulkes and tzitzis and got involved with idolatry. What it means is that at any of these points in history, it would crop up in certain places. Individuals would get more involved in it. And as we've seen, the style of the Navi is Hashem blasts the entire Jewish nation when individuals start getting involved, when there's any presence of Avodah Zarah of the Jewish people. So let's see. I would like to continue. After these two shoftim died, and now the Jewish people are left without a leader. Vayasifu b'nei Yisrael asay sorah b'inei Hashem. And the Jewish people continued to do what was wrong, what was bad in the eyes of Hashem. What do you mean they continued? Hadn't we just seen a period of 45 years where everything was great? The answer is basically on what we just said now. What continued means that yes, everything was great for 45 years, but the people who weren't really applying themselves, the people who were eyeing the other nations with a certain temptation, when can I try that? There were already sour roots developing inside. These roots developed and sprouted once there was no leader, once there wasn't an active effort to keep everybody up to par. That's what it means they continued. It means it developed. The problematic roots that had struck in the hearts of some of the people, of the lower level of the people, started sprouting now. But now, many different Avodah Zarahs came into style. They worshipped the Baalim, that's Ashtaroth, that's Elohei Aram, the gods of Aram, that's Elohei Tzidon, the gods of Tzidon, that's Elohei Moav, Elohei Bnei Amon, Elohei Plishtim. They were looking for all different cultures and styles, the fashions of all the different places, right? Each one had its uniqueness, each one had its beautiful elements. Vayazvu et Hashem v'lo yavadu, and they forsook Hashem, and they did not serve Him. Vayichar af Hashem beYisrael, and Hashem grew angry with the Jewish people. Vayimkerem beYad Plishtim or beYad Bnei Amon, and He sold them into the hands of the Plishtim and to the hands of the children of the people of Amon. Also, an ironic common phenomenon. Right, they start trying to mingle with this nation and with that nation. This nation and that nation turns against them. Right, they started adopting the practices, the cultures, the gods of the Plishtim and the children of Amon. Now the Plishtim and the children of Amon turned into their enemies. It started becoming persecutors of the Jewish people. And they persecuted and crushed the Jewish people immediately on that year, meaning on the year when this deterioration set in, immediately the problems developed. It wasn't a very long passage of time. As soon as that first club got together to dabble in some Plishti worship, it was a matter of imminently the Plishtim came and the Amoidim came to persecute them. Shmanes Veshana. And this continued for 18 years. Eskol B'nei Yisrael Asher Be'eva Yardin. Initially, it started just with the periphery. It started with the people of Yisrael who lived on the Transjordan, on the other side of the Yardin. This was only 2.5 tribes, right? They didn't actually move into Eretz Yisrael. Be'eret Amori Asher Be'Gilad. In the land of the Amori that was in Gilad. But then, it got worse. The people of Amon crossed the Jordan, entered Eretz Yisrael proper. And now they started challenging the most powerful tribes. Yehuda, Binyamin, Ephraim. These are the more powerful tribes. Already at the heart of Eretz Yisrael. And they distressed Yisrael greatly. And the Jewish people picked up on the message. Vayizaku b'nei Yisrael el Hashem lemar. And the Jewish people cried out to Hashem, saying, Chatanu lach, we sin to you. V'chi ozavnu es Eloheinu, v'na'avod es ha'ba'olim. We sin to you by forsaking Hashem and worshipping the Ba'olim. Alright. So, here also, okay, there certainly was a level of improvement. But here also, in a sense, and this is what Hashem is going to address now, this is also turning into a pattern. You do what you want, problems develop, then you come back and you say, Oh, sorry. That's also meant to be a set pattern that just repeats itself time and time again. So listen to Hashem's response now. Hashem says to the children of Israel, he gives a list of a whole bunch of nations. All these people oppressed you. And you cried out to me. Time and time again I saved you, both in the past with the Mitzrayim, also in recent times. You saw already what I can do for you. Why do you keep forsaking me? And you have forsaken me. Again, we keep saying forsaken. Yeah, the accusation that some individuals, at certain pockets of the Jewish people, started dabbling in idolatry is leveled as an accusation against the Jewish people as a whole. So he says, "Vatem azavtem oisi." You have forsaken me. Vata'avdu elohim acherim. And you have served other gods. Lachain loy oisif loy she'aeschem. Frightening thing Hashem says. This time, it's not going to happen. This time, I'm not going to save you. But Hashem gives them an eitzah. You found other gods, right? L'chum ezaku elelehim asher echadem bam. Go cry out to all these different gods you discovered. You discovered all kinds of great gods. Go cry out to them. Hey, bo yishu lochem eis tzoraschem. Let them save you at your time of trouble.
And that, even though it's coming sarcasm, did this be misconstrued sort of Hashem mattering idol worship at this particular moment?
This certainly no Jew would misconstrue. This form of cynicism was used all throughout the Navi. Right? Go to them. Actually, it's already in the Torah. Yakumu v'yazruchem, Hashem says sarcastically. Let them get up and save you. You dropped me for them, let them get up and save you. So this is not. But there was a different test here. What are the Jewish people, how are they supposed to respond when they hear such a response to Hashem? The Jewish people repented. Now what does repenting mean? Let's note, it wasn't. We said that the whole Jewish people repented. That means that they got together. They gathered together. We're not just talking about a haphazard occurrence. The whole Jewish people repenting means that they gathered together and they acknowledged and they made assemblies and they had public tefillahs, etc. And they get a response. They never got such a response from the Navi. What would you do as a Jewish people getting such a response? Hashem says, no, this happened time and time again. I'm not going to save you anymore. This was a test. This was a test. What's going to happen now? And basically what Hashem was pushing at was, is this going to be a repeat? A repeat I'm not going to do. Can it be something deeper? Now this was a test if the Jewish people would understand it that way. Or, here was what you said, this could be misconstrued. They could say, alright, we're finished with Hashem. So, let's start researching. Which of the other gods can we apply to for help? Right? Hashem told them clearly, I'm not going to help you anymore. We're done. Right? But the Jewish people passed the test. And they said no. Even though Hashem said, I'm not going to save you anymore, they understood. And they reached an even deeper level of tshuva. Vayomru b'nei Yisrael al Hashem. And the b'nei Yisrael said to Hashem, Chatanu, we have sinned. Asei atal lanu k'chol atoyveinoch. And they say, we're deserving of punishment? Fine. We're putting ourselves into your hand and do whatever you want to us. Achatzileinu no hayom hazeh. But don't save us from them. Meaning, in other words, found the point, which, as we're going to see very soon, is really going to bring out the love of Hashem to the Jewish people. They're saying to Hashem, if you are indeed sick of us, chas v'shalom, if you're indeed sick of us, take us back and give it to us good over the head. Give us a good beating. Torture us. Kill us. Not the goyim. Don't. We are not going to accept the situation where Hashem is saying, I'm turning around, that's it, I'm gone, let them do with you whatever they want. The Jewish people are saying, if we have to suffer, fine, but in your hands, we want to maintain that connection to you, we want to regain that connection to you. Even if we've reached a point where you're not going to forgive, we prefer to be in your hands and for you to be meeting out very harsh punishment rather than a situation that Hashem says, I'm departing, and now let nature run its course. This is what the Jewish people are saying. And to be zeichet to that level, they want to merit what? What are they trying to merit now? They're not trying to merit salvation. They're trying to merit that Hashem should personally punish them. What they do in order to merit this? They made a complete about face. They eradicated any of the idol worship among them. They turned back to worship Hashem. And what was Hashem's response? Again, what were they trying to achieve? Let Hashem punish us. But the response was, like the pasuk says elsewhere, "Hamu me'alei kiviyocho." Hashem's insides churned with rachmanis for His people. "Vatikta nafshoi." This is a very scary expression. It's used in the pasuk. Hashem could no longer tolerate Ba'amal Yisrael, the pain of the Jewish people. Kiviyocho, already now Hashem said, "Oi, it's too much for me to bear." So now, yes, they did merit, not just that Hashem was going to take them back and punish them, and punish them Himself, due to them what the other nations were doing to them. No. All of a sudden now it reached that back to that situation of that supreme love, where they managed to realign themselves with Hashem and they got themselves back to the natural state where Kiviyochol Hashem hurts with their pain. That's where they were now. And now Hashem accepts their tshuva. And He's not going to tolerate their abuse anymore. So now what happens? Vayitzaku b'nei amoim vayachanu b'gil'od. So Hashem orchestrated the coming developments. The people of Amon decided that they want to now make an all-out war against the Jewish people, overrun all of Eretz Yisrael. So they rallied together and they camped in Gil'od. Vayasfu b'nei Yisrael vayachanu b'mitzvah. And the Jewish people, in desperate response, again, they didn't know yet what their standing was. They didn't know what's going to happen here. They knew that things were going from bad to worse over the last 18 years. And now all of a sudden, they see Amon mobilizing for a very major attack. So they gathered, they mobilized to defend themselves in Mitzpah. And the people of Gilad, the officers of Gilad, said to each other, Miha'ish asher yochel lihilochim b'vnei Amon. Who can be the man who will lead us, who will be able to go to battle for us against the children of Amon? If we find a man who can do that, find a man who will be willing to take on this campaign against Amon, which was very formidable. These people had been creaming the Jewish people for the last 18 years. We will appoint him as the head of all of Gilad, meaning basically we'll make him the governor of Gilad. So who is it going to be? So here we end off this perek with the Jewish people in this desperate situation. We've already seen that the whole state really changed behind the scenes. Hashem's whole approach changed. And now it went from, you know, look for your other gods, to Hashem can no longer tolerate the suffering. But they're still in this world. They're not necessarily attuned to what's going on upstairs. And what they see is the people of Amon rallying against them, and they're gathering together for a desperate defense, looking desperately to find someone who can lead them. And from here we'll go, Bezos Hashem, next week into the very intriguing story of Yiftach.